Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 24 for Tuesday, November 10th. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me I've got
Dominic Rabi
and Ben Snitkoff.
And there's also a good chance that David Liu might join us today, but a few minutes late. As usual, we've got our three great stories for you this week, including a story on high school drama, MySpace, and school punishment. Legal tabloid Above the Law has also been sued by a professor in Miami. And finally, we have a case on Bluebeat.com, which has apparently tried to beat Apple into the Beatles digital music race. And in the process, they got sued. So getting started, this new MySpace case that popped up this week is pretty interesting. It involves two students at an Indiana high school. Both were sophomores and both were minors. And what happened is sort of a little bit racy, but they during a summer sleepover, these two girls got together and were taking pictures of themselves kissing and licking a large multicolored novelty lollipop-shaped phallus object. And then they subsequently posted those on their MySpace pages. At some point before the school year began, the pictures had leaked out to school officials, and based on some of the policies that the school has instituted, the school suspended them from extracurricular activities and gave them the option of going to counseling and having that penalty reduced to, I think, 25% of all extracurricular activities. So do you guys have any more thoughts on the facts of this case before we jump into some of the law?
The interesting thing for... go ahead, Ben.
No, mine was just going to be that I'm pretty sure it should be a phallus-shaped lollipop and not a lollipop-shaped phallus.
I'm really interested in that part of it because I took that quote directly out of the complaint. So that's the wording that the plaintiffs use in this case. And I would agree with you, Ben. I think that's probably the case, but this is all we have. And, of course, the photographs are not available online, probably especially because these two girls are minors.
The interesting thing to me in this case was that they originally posted these photos up to MySpace with privacy controls on them, so only their friends could view them. It's not like they posted this and it was publicly accessible. It was only available to their friends, and presumably the principal is not their friend on MySpace, and he actually doesn't say how he got the photos.
I think that one can assume that obviously somebody with access to either of these two girls' MySpace pages, maybe a parent saw it or something, and a concerned parent, or maybe another school, another student from the school had submitted it to the administration.
I just think it's an interesting sort of note in terms of people think they have privacy, but you can just show it to someone who, I mean, there's not any real control over it. Once you post something on the internet, it can go anywhere. So.
Right. So this is I think an especially interesting topic because we're talking about expression and rights to free speech as you are a minor that is in a public high school. And if I think back to my high school days, I have these somewhat bitter memories about this one history teacher who told the entire class that as a student, you really don't have any rights under the Bill of Rights, and that's because we were minors. And of course later I found that out to be incorrect as I went through law school and stuff, but what exactly are a student in high school's rights to the ability to engage in expressive activity or speech?
So as a general rule, a student can engage in any speech that's non-disruptive, and then other than that, anything that isn't also reasonably bannable and banned by the school. So a recent case, Bong Hits for Jesus, said that, you know, while the drug-related advocacy that was going on the sign that a kid held up that said Bong Hits for Jesus, while it wasn't necessarily disruptive, it advocates drug use, and the schools can, you know, ban drug use because they've got a very important, if not compelling, interest in keeping their kids off drugs.
So the interesting thing about Bong Hits for Jesus and what's somewhat analogous with this case, because this case, again, they posted this on MySpace. They were photos from summer vacation. School wasn't in session. This wasn't a school MySpace account. This was their own MySpace account. And in Bong Hits for Jesus, they got the day off from school to watch the Olympic torch pass by, and they were out of school and held the banner up.
Right.
And well, that's a... I think they were in school, and then in the Bong Hits case, that is, and they had been excused from class.
Right.
I think one of the individuals who was a party in the case, though, had shown up late that day to school.
Right. It was ostensibly a school event.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That was the reasoning of the court in the end, that this was a school-sponsored activity.
Whereas in this case, I would say that this, I mean, your MySpace profile is not a school event in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
Is it?
No, it isn't, but I think you can make the argument.
I think in this case it potentially isn't, but I think it could be, though.
I was going to say, you can make the argument that if you do something on your MySpace, like, let's say I get into a fight outside of school, you know, that's the kind of thing that has a potential to be disruptive even in school, with people talking about the fight, you know, if I come in all, you know, the big,
bruised?
A big bruise, you know, a black eye, people are going to...
I can tell you have a lot of experience
with
fight.
This, Ben. If I come in with a big black eye, people are going to, you know, want to take time out of class to discuss how I got that big black eye. I don't think it's impossible to say that out-of-school activity can be disruptive in school. It's a tough argument as far as, you know, where are you going to draw that line, though, you know? Can the school, you know, keep me from playing in a certain extracurricular sport because it may be disruptive to the sports that I play at school? You know, I don't think that's the case. I don't think a school could go that far.
Right, so this is all based on this policy that the school has instituted, and it basically, to summarize their policy, it gives power through the athletic association, because these were actually student athletes, and one of the big issues was that they were being excluded from the athletic activities for the entire year. And that policy said that if conduct out of school reflects discredit on the school, or if it creates a disruptive influence on discipline, good order, moral values, or the educational environment, then at the school's discretion, they can deal with the students as they see fit, basically.
Right, and the father actually tried to appeal the decision of the superintendent. I think it was the superintendent in this case.
Yes.
And the superintendent said, you know, whatever, you can complain all you want, but I have total discretion in this case, and I'm, you know, putting my foot down and making these girls go into counseling if they want to continue to play sports.
So what ended up coming out of this is that the ACLU stepped in, and they filed, along with the two plaintiff sophomore girls, whose names have not been disclosed, of course, because they're minors, stepped in and filed a complaint against the school, claiming all sorts of damages. They also asserted it to be a class action, which I don't think has been certified yet. But the class, of course, consists of all present and future students who are at the school. And in terms of damages, they are, of course, asking for some type of injunctive relief to prevent the school from engaging in any type of punishment along these lines, as well as that they, so part of what the school had offered the girls was they could go into these counseling services and make a formal apology both to the athletic board and to the school. And if they did that, then their punishment would have been reduced down to 25% of school activities would have been they would have been suspended from. They ended up doing that, but now they're looking for in the complaint to have the records of those counseling services destroyed. Do we think that the school in any way, though, under the current state of the law, has any right to punish the girls based on this activity?
I think it's a stretch of any current Supreme Court case to say that it's fine for them to go after a student for something that they do outside of school. I'm not aware of any Supreme Court case that has reached that issue. And in fact, they kind of specifically avoided it and more saying, you know, they didn't get to the question as to whether or not it was in school activity. They got to the question as to, I'm sorry, they didn't get to the question as to whether or not it was out of school activity. They instead just said it was close enough to in school activity that we're going to call it in school activity.
Yes, and interestingly too, in these school speech cases, which don't come up very often, I think we've only had a few over the last several years that involve similar facts to this case, and even then, they don't really seem to involve cases where you have online activity, and that's the basis for some sort of nexus to school activity. But the last notable one that I can think of is the 1986, the Bethel School District v. Frazier, which is just commonly called Frazier. And that involved the student who was making a speech that was chock full of metaphors and other references to
innuendos.
sexual innuendo and vulgar type stuff. Is that case, does that case here have any weight? And the holding of that case, by the way, was that where the student had made this speech, he was later, I think, suspended, and he was precluded from graduating at the end of the year. The Supreme Court held in that case that the school did, in fact, have the right to step in and punish him based on those activities. Even though that was a school event where he was in the auditorium, is there any way, though, that ruling might have any impact on the current case?
Well, go ahead then if you want to dive in.
I mean, there is some slight similarity in that this case involved girls doing things that girls do at a slumber party, and Frasier involved a kid making sexual innuendo. I mean, they're both kind of sexual in nature, but other than that, part of the problem with Frasier is that it was a the Supreme Court was worried about the kids getting rowdy because it was in front of a large group of people, and it was during school. This case is just it's so factually different that any comparison between the two really bothers me. This was outside of school. This wasn't in front of groups of people. It was distributed, but it was distributed again outside of the school network. It was just distributed only to friends in a passive manner. It wasn't even like they, sent these pictures, emailed these pictures around. They just posted them on a MySpace page. You'd have to go to the page to see them. Dominic, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm sort of conflicted on this case because, in one sense, they did agree with the athletic code, which says that anything creating a disruptive influence on the discipline, good order, and gives them the principal the right to bar from school activities students who do that. And I don't fully agree with the ACLU's argument that this doesn't impact the school environment at all, because I think it kind of does in some ways. I mean, it certainly is disruptive to the classroom, although not intentionally so. Like,
Wow,
it's not
yeah,
done
I
for
can
the
remember.
purposes of being disruptive.
I can remember my days in high school, and we didn't have, MySpace and all of that stuff back then. And a lot of people weren't even online back then, too. But if something like this had come up, it probably would have been the talk of the school for a good couple of weeks, regardless if it had received the level of media attention that this case has.
Right. I guess my point is that it's disruptive, but it's not intentionally disruptive. Like, it's distinguished from, say, the Frasier case, where he was giving the speech for the purposes of, I mean, it was at school. It was pretty obvious that it was going to be disruptive, and he could have reasonably foreseen that it was going to be disruptive. Here, I don't know whether they could have reasonably foreseen that something that they uploaded to a friends only MySpace photo album would have found its way to the principal and then gotten them banned and then gotten a court case. I mean, that doesn't seem reasonably foreseeable to me. I don't know whether a court would find it that way or whether this is even the standard. I don't think it is. But that's just sort of my seat of the pants, this seems right to me, legal analysis.
So my problem too is, and I was discussing this a little bit with Ben before we got the show going today, is that the Frasier case definitely said that the school had some interest in a protectable interest in punishing lewd and indecent, but not necessarily obscene behavior. And that case also laid out the standard that it also had to be disruptive. Now, the Morse case, which came much later in 2007, that sort of distinguished Frasier and said, well, we're more concerned that this had to do with drug activity, and the fact that what happened at the as the torch was coming by wasn't necessarily disruptive to the classroom, didn't really play that much weight. But the school has all this; they have an interest in protecting pro-drug-like statements, like bong hits for Jesus. So to me, if you read those two cases together, and especially the latter one, which seems to say that you don't really need to have this disruptive behavior component so much, or at least it doesn't play as much of a role as the previous cases had suggested. If you read those two together, then it would seem that, yeah, the school probably does have some interest in protecting vulgar activity that's lewd but not necessarily obscene. And I think you could argue that in this case, the photographs that the girls had posted probably qualifies as that. And if you don't have that disruptive, if you don't need to prove that disruptive element, it could seem like in some way that, yeah, it's possible that the school might have some right to govern these outside activities. I think the biggest fact that hurts that, though, is that this occurred at some point during the summer when school was not even in session. And the punishment came as the girls went back into the school session and were then banned from their activities. I think it would have been a much stronger argument on the school side if this had actually happened during the school year.
Right. Before we wrap this up, I just want to add a couple of things really quickly. First of all, if this were in fact obscene, which the pictures in this case were not obscene, I don't think anyone's alleging that, there would have been no protectable First Amendment or free speech interest in it whatsoever, and the school could have done whatever they want. Secondly, in Frazier, the court concentrated a lot on the fact that the speech was offensive, and what the school in Morse v. Frederick, the Bong Hits for Jesus case, was trying to do was extend that offensive language to encompass drug-related speech. And the court in Morse v. Frederick said, you know what, we're not going to take that offensive language. We're going to stick to it's either disruptive or it's doing something else that the school has an interest in stopping, like drug promoting activity. Because the school has an interest in keeping their kids off drugs, they can do that.
That's a great point, Ben. Yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, the Morse court definitely said that under the guise of what you might be able to consider offensive, it's an incredibly broad term, and you can almost take any statement, including protected political speech, to be offensive to somebody. So I think it was just a little too wishy-washy, so they sort of threw that metric out. Any final thoughts before we move on?
That's all I've got.
It looks like we are trying to add David Liu, who is now available. Let's see if we can get him on the line. So anyways, David, just to bring you up to speed real quick, we just capped off our first story on the MySpace photos that came up this week. But I think we can pull ahead and move on as long as you're with us. And we have our second story, and that involves this website called Above the Law. Above the Law is sort of known to be something of a legal tabloid. They cover a lot of gossip. In addition to covering some really interesting stories and breaking legal news, but they often have a lot of provocative commentary that's laced within the blog and sometimes a lot within the comments. This particular case dates back to, I believe, October 2007, when a University of Miami law professor, so an actual professor at the law school, and I believe his expertise is in constitutional matters and criminal procedure, among other things. He was detained by police for allegedly, and I don't know what the outcome of this ever was, but allegedly soliciting an undercover police officer for sexual services. And Above the Law got wind that this had happened, I think through some of the public documents and, you know, probably some emails that were tipping them off to the story. And they wrote a series of posts back in October of 2007 discussing the case. And they also had published in one of their posts a picture of this professor whose name is Donald Jones, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, but he goes by D. Marvin Jones.
D. Marvin Jones. That's interesting because I think that's a point that one of the parties made in the case, but I guess we'll get to that, about what his name actually is and how they refer to him on the blog. Anyway, so they had published his photograph that appears on the university website under his faculty biography page, and they also post in another separate post, they posted a comic graphic, which it sort of involved like a mashup of it looked like his face or one that looks pretty similar to him, and basically remaking the scene and poking fun at him a little bit. So now here we are a little bit more than 2 years later. This law professor filed a suit against Above the Law for the series of posts. And in his complaint, he alleged false light, invasion of privacy, and copyright infringement, interestingly. So do you guys want to give any more background on the case?
One thing I would add is that the cartoon that was allegedly portrayed him in a false light was made by a reader of Above the Law and sent into Above the Law, which they then published. I think that's going to be an important fact a little later in the conversation.
Right, and actually a lot of this might even be moot because just a few days after the suit was filed, this law professor voluntarily dropped the suit. And so now the suit no longer exists, but I think that there's a lot of interesting things here to discuss in terms of what a legal blog like Above the Law's legal obligations are and you know, in terms of what they had done back in October 2007 and the lawsuit itself. First off, the claims are pretty interesting here because, especially the copyright claim. The copyright claim was, I believe, in the complaint based on the usage of his faculty biography picture on the blog. And he alleged that the republication of that into the blog constituted copyright infringement. What do you guys think about that?
First thing I want to say is he failed to allege that he owned the registration for said copyright, which would get the case dismissed out of kind. So, yes. So, two things. First, he never alleged that he owned the image, which he probably didn't own it. It was probably owned by the school or the photographer who took the picture. And secondly, I'm going to go and say that it's fair use to put the person's picture next to a story about them.
Right, so those are two huge points that really factor in favor of the website. And I think absolutely correctly, as you mentioned, so when you're a faculty member and you have your pictures taken for, or a photograph of you taken for the purposes of posting it on the website, it's not actually taken by the professor itself, or presumably not taken by the professor itself. Usually you have some sort of, you know, professional entity who is doing, you know, headshots. And they're actually the ones who are fixing the expression of the photograph into a tangible medium. So at least, assuming that there are no contractual agreements between the parties, the copyright would then vest in the photographer himself. And usually in those cases, too, if there are contracts at issue, the ownership of that particular picture might then, it's more likely that it would go to the school, but not to the professor himself. And that's certainly one of the baseline components that you need to have in a copyright infringement claim, that you are in fact the lawful owner of the work, or that you've been delegated some sort of legal authority to assert the works of a third party. That doesn't really seem to be the case here, and it was imperfectly pleaded in the complaint.
My question is, what sort of actual legal paperwork would you need to assert that? So, I mean, say I have, I mean, there's a picture on my academic website of me. I actually don't know who took the picture. It's sort of just a casual picture. You know, do I own copyright on that? Does the unknown photographer own copyright on that? Or is it just sort of out there now?
So whomever took the picture would own the copyright, but you still couldn't sue for copyright infringement until you registered the copyright. So you'd have to send a copy of the picture in along with the fee to the Library of Congress. They would register the copyright, send you back a little sheet of paper that says this has been registered, registration number XYZ. And then in the complaint, you would say, I own this registration, the registration number is XYZ, it was registered on such and such a date.
Right.
So putting copyright David Liu underneath it will not likely stand up in court.
Well, it not so much that, but the fact that you haven't registered a work doesn't mean that you don't get copyright protection. It just stops you from bringing a lawsuit. You have to register it before you file the lawsuit itself. You still have rights that date back to the original fixation.
Right, and the other thing is, if you don't register it, you can't get statutory damages until the date of registration. So even if I register, you infringe my copyright, and I register the copyright and then sue you for it, I can't get statutory damages for any infringement that occurred before the date that I registered it.
Okay.
So that's definitely how a lot of people approach copyright. I mean, the registration process is how people approach these large damage-based cases of copyright infringement. Interesting also, this would be most likely a case of fair use as well, too. Let's assume that he did in fact have the rights and it was in fact properly registered. It was just imperfectly pleaded in the complaint. I think that Above the Law certainly would have a great case for fair use. Anyone have any thoughts on the fair use component of this?
I mean, you're using the entire work, but you're using it for a different reason. You're not using it to advertise the person. You're using it in conjunction with a news story. You're using no more of the work than is necessary to, you know, show a picture of the guy. It's going right along with commentary. I think you've got a fairly good fair use claim there.
Any other thoughts, Dominic?
I would agree with the fair use.
I mean, that pretty much covers it. I mean, if fair use exists so that you can have these types of uses, especially when it comes down to critical commentary and usage in news-related resources. I guess you could probably argue a little bit whether or not a legal tabloid blog really constitutes news, but seems like a pretty thin argument here. So nonetheless, it would have been a very strong argument for fair use, but it doesn't seem like the defendants above the law had to even think about asserting that in this case, because the complaint on its face was just imperfect, and it could have been dismissed before you even got to any of the substantive law that governs this particular area. What about the false light claims? Any thoughts on the false light claim or the invasion of privacy?
Well, false light, other than the fact that Florida doesn't recognize false light as a cause of action, I don't have very much to comment on that. So I guess to explain that a little bit is false light is it falls into what's called a privacy tort, and privacy torts vary from state to state. They vary in both whether or not the state says that, you know, such a cause of action exists, whether or not you can recover for damages if somebody, you know, does an act that would constitute putting you in a false light. Again, that varies from state to state, whether or not they have it, what elements are part of it. Like in Massachusetts, defamation, if somebody defames you, the person who is defamed has the burden of proving that it wasn't true. That varies from state to state.
Well, interestingly here, where what above law, the law had used in its post were the actual police reports, and those are part of the public record. So if they're going based on what the police were alleging was the criminal activity in this case, you have a kind of an uphill battle on a false light claim, I would think, and an invasion of privacy claim too.
Right, I agree. Particularly with the invasion of privacy. So you can't invade somebody's privacy if something is in the public and open like that. I think you've got a slightly better argument on false light, because you're not going to be protected from portraying somebody in a false light just because a police report said it was true. If the police report was wrong and if the police report put the person in a false light and you're reprinting the police report, I don't think you get any special immunity from false light. Dominic, do you have any thoughts on that?
Not really, no.
Yeah, I think that it really hurts the false light claim especially, and the invasion of privacy. I mean, even if you could assume that the for some reason accessing the police record still constituted some sort of breach of personal privacy, you have another interesting component to this, is that this is a law professor. And not only that, he is a lecturer on criminal procedure and constitutional law. And I think also in the Above the Law post, they had pointed out that he has written several books on racism and the constitutionality of certain things that happen under the guise of police activity. And so it was sort of assumed that that was going to be raised as a defense in this. I guess it should be pointed out that this particular law professor happened to be a African American, so that would have been maybe one of the bases for a defense. I really don't know where that where that criminal action went in the end, and what the end result was of that. But it seems that based on his faculty biography and the way that he is credited as being a public intellectual figure, and I think Eric Goldman actually in his blog post pointed a lot of this out, that he had, or the school or himself had held him out to be something of a public intellectual figure, that he was a lecturer on these matters and some sort of constitutional law expert. It would seem that all of that might make him into be a public figure, and so that would really trump a lot of the invasion of privacy issues as well.
It
even
says,
if you could say
specifically
that
on his website, the same website that the picture came from, you know, that as a public intellectual, Professor Jones has written numerous editorials for this and this, and has appeared on these TV shows. So
major network TV shows,
portraying him as a public figure.
Right. So this was, and by the way, another interesting little tidbit about this case is that in his complaint, I believe he was asking for $44 million in relief based on the damage that had been caused to him for these above the law postings. Looks like luckily we don't have to do too much predictive analysis in this, because he ended up voluntarily dismissing the suit a few days later. And I don't know that, or at least I haven't seen anything that he has written since then, but it would have been interesting, I think, to hear his side of the story. Do you guys have any other thoughts? What about the graphic, Ben? I think that you had pointed something out to me in the Communications Decency Act.
Right. So the graphic was made by a reader of Above the Law, submitted to Above the Law, and then Above the Law posted it. One person suggested that Above the Law would be immune because of the Communications Decency Act, because they're an internet service provider, and they posted content that was made by another. That was,
I saw that in Eric Goldman's blog post. It might have appeared in other places.
Yeah, I recall reading it somewhere else. And I think that's technically right, but I think that's a bad use of the Communications Decency Act.
You know what? I'm very conflicted on that, because it would seem that Above the Law had been emailed that graphic, and they had posted a little tidbit of the email as well, and it seemed like they had to exercise some form of editorial control and make a decision on whether or not they should post it. And wouldn't that kind of trump the whole issue of that being user-generated content that was posted by a third party?
It would, except for the fact that, and I meant to go back and relook at this case again, I think there was a case that involved AOL and Drudge, wherein AOL paid Drudge to republish Drudge's material. And I think that republishing was an important part in that case, because it wasn't that they were taking the material, editing it, and reposting it. They were just giving Matt Drudge a fee to republish the content from his blog onto AOL's own site. And in that case, AOL was immune from liability, because they didn't exert any editorial control. I think this case kind of falls in between. It's not that there's no editorial control, because clearly they decided to pick this particular one up and publish it. It's tough. I don't think it falls down clearly one side or the other.
If they had just linked out to the website which had originally contained the graphic, rather than taking it from as like an email attachment or something and then posting it, and I think they hosted it too on the blog itself. I didn't notice that it was, linked out or something like that, and they were just grabbing the image from another site.
It was hosted.
It was hosted, yeah. So if they had just linked out and said, oh, hey, look, there's a lot of people commenting on this, and some people are making interesting cartoons and mashups about this incident, that would have been completely different, because they were just pointing out what other people were saying, whereas here it seems more like they were taking the content that was given to them and then making a decision to publish it, and that would seem to kind of trump the Communications Decency Act defense. Well, in any event, we luckily don't have to think too hard about that, because the case is gone. So any final thoughts before we move on to the last story?
I'm all set.
All set.
Good to go.
Okay, and our final story is a pretty interesting one. It involves a website called Bluebeat.com and also the Beatles, the Beatles music group. The famous one, or perhaps the infamous one, the Beatles have been under the public spotlight in recent years because they are one of the few major recording artists of that era that have not yet permitted their entire discography to be available through online music services like iTunes. And in particular, I think iTunes is the big one that everyone has been waiting to see whether or not the Beatles music will be available on it. And interestingly, Ars Technica pointed out that at nearly every Apple event that pops up, meaning all these the major Apple news conferences that they hold when they release new products, before the news conferences, there's always a ton of speculation on whether or not this particular news conference will be the one where it's announced that Beatles music will finally be available. I think also another thing that was coming up recently is that some of the Beatles music, or maybe all of it, maybe you could tell me, Ben, is going to be available on a USB disk, or excuse me, USB drive, a little flash drive, and it will be sold, a limited number of them will be sold to the public.
Right.
And
14 albums. So one thing I don't know is whether or not these albums will be the stereo remasters or the mono. Plus,
I think there's, 12 tracks that have been remastered, and now...
More than 12 tracks have been... they digitally remastered all of them. Some of them were remastered mono, and some of them were remastered stereo. This really doesn't matter. The interesting thing about that, the digital publication, is that they're going to put both FLAC, lossless encoding, on it, and I think it was 320 kilobit a second MP3s. So you'll have the lossless versions, and you'll have the MP3s that you can just immediately load onto an iPod or other MP3 player.
Right, so in other words, pretty high-quality digital releases, especially in terms of the FLAC, the lossless codec, and the, I guess, the MP3. I mean, it's a compressed file, but 328 is still pretty decent.
Yeah, it will cost $280, which is $20 an album, which is pretty absurd considering they're digital. But
are they putting any DRM on the device?
Not that I know of, but I think that's pretty... no one's sure. It does come with the 16-gigabyte flash drive, but I don't know if the flash drive is going to be read-only or if you're going to have full permissions to do whatever you want with the flash drive after you get your music off of it.
It is... I'm looking at an article here. It is in stereo, and there's also 13 mini documentaries and a lot of pictures on it, and it should also be noted that the USB stick is in the shape of an apple.
Right. I understand you pull out the stem of the apple, and that's where the USB drive is. So you've got an apple that... The bulk of the apple acts as a base, and it's not like you've got a gigantic garish apple sticking out of your computer at all time.
Looks like a great paperweight. I'm looking at a picture of it right now.
A very expensive paperweight.
Seems to be begging for a, you know, suit. It's like it's a vaguely apple-shaped MP3 device. I don't know. I mean, it kind of reminds me of that, of Apple suing that Australian company that we talked about a couple weeks ago.
That's a good point, because I think one of the contentions between Apple, as in like the Apple computer company, and the Beatles as to why they don't want to release their music onto iTunes is the fact that Apple has the logo Apple. And I think that was the there was some sort of Apple Corporation which...
Yep.
There have been at least three lawsuits about Apple's use of
Apple Records.
I'm sorry, Apple Incorporated, which is what Apple Computer is now calling themselves. Apple Incorporated's use of music in relation to their computers. So that's been an ongoing feud between them.
Yeah, the Apple, there's another Apple Corporation that was the entity that handled all of the Beatles records.
Founded in 1968 as a subcorp of Apple Core, Apple Records. So they had a whole bushel of Apple companies, if I may say so.
Yes. I mean, that's not so much at issue in the cases we're about to talk about, but... you know, apparently that has some weight in why the Beatles music is not available digitally across iTunes yet. I don't know any more about it than that, though. So to get back into this case, though, we have this website, bluebeat.com, and they went ahead on October 30th, before the release of this Apple USB paperweight device, and they now have all of the Beatles songs available for streaming across their website with unlimited plays, and they're also selling the tracks for 25 cents each. And this created a huge stir because nobody has been able to get the Beatles songs digitally across the internet in any form like that yet, at least not legally. So this prompted a couple of questions, and EMI, which is now the parent company which owns a lot of the Beatles rights, has come out and said, yeah, we don't think that there's any permission here for them to do that. And Bluebeat.com has come back and said, well, actually, we do have full authorization, and we're paying all the applicable royalties that we would owe to any of the parties in this case. And, you know, we're allowed to do this. So there's a lot of weird things going on in this case and some really interesting novel legal claims. Does anyone want to give us a rundown on what those are?
Dominic, you started to talk before I started to talk. You should talk about this instead of me.
I'm not sure whether novel is perhaps novel is a, or, well, it's a kind word.
I think we covered clearly.
We well-defined the term novel legal.
Okay, yes. Within the context of the podcast.
A novel argument is like saying that somebody has what was the phrase I used? A nice personality. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, anyway, Dominic.
So basically, the fundamental claim that they're making is that they've created a new audiovisual work from the original sound recordings because they ran them through a psychoacoustical model and added some artist pictures into the MP3 file. Psychoacoustical.
What is a psychoacoustic model?
I'm not entirely clear, but I think it has something to do with acoustics and being psycho.
One of the guys from Bluebeat said was, psychoacoustic simulations are my synthetic creation of that series of sounds which best expresses the way I believe a particular memory or melody should be heard as a live performance. What that actually entails technically, I really can't tell.
Well,
I think basically what the fundamental thing of their argument is, they are saying that, look, we're not just selling the songs. We're selling the songs after they've been run through our psychoacoustical thing, which basically makes it as if you were actually there by simulating a live musical performance and adding all sorts of interesting acoustical properties into the audio file that make it so that when you listen to it, you're going to feel like it's there. So we've created a new work. We're not redistributing the old thing. We're creating a derivative work. And we're rearranging it, and it's an independent fixation. Therefore, we have copyright to it.
Yeah. So as I read the explanation, they're weaving in album art into the MP3 file itself, along with some other graphic representation that you can see with when you play the music on their player.
Yes, I think what the core issue is that they're saying not only that. They're saying not only that this is a new work, but it's a live performance. Because even if it were just a derivative work, they wouldn't have any right to create a derivative work. What they can do is do a live performance or a cover of the song. And if you do a cover, you're subject to that mechanical license, that statutory mechanical license that we were talking about a few weeks ago. You know, I think it's 9 cents per song, per album, plus a little more for songs that are longer than a certain length.
Well, that's part of it, but what about the streaming aspect? Wouldn't you then have to secure rights for some sort of digital transmission or a public performance?
Only if it wasn't that their new cover that they claim it is, the live performance or a new cover.
So what they're actually saying here is that they're creating an entirely new copyrightable work that is separate and apart from any of the copyrights that the Beatles or EMI or any of the rights owners have.
That's my understanding.
I have to take issue with that, just because it seems like there is no real meaningful transformation of any sort of audio data. I mean, you can argue that there's something new in the addition of pictures, although, I mean, I don't even know if they have copyright whatever on those pictures. But, I mean, unless they're substantially changing the audio, it's still identifiable as the Beatles and... No one, and they're selling it as the Beatles, and I think it would be hard to argue that it's something other than the Beatles singing whatever song.
Right, so they did actually provide some sort of legal authority to support that argument under Section 114 of the Copyright Act. Did anyone really understand that?
That's what I was trying to get across, that they're saying that, you know, the modeling that they put it through, they call it the psychoacoustic simulation, which I think is just a fancy word for compressing out the stuff that you can't hear in a sound recording. They're saying that that creates a new sound recording, like, essentially like a cover, but I don't buy it.
So what does Section 114B say in the Copyright Act? Does anyone have it handy?
It says that you can make a new version of a song, like a live version, a cover, or even studio versions, and those are new works. They're new works that are copyrightable.
Does that apply, though, to anybody, or is it mostly just applied to the actual copyright owner?
A cover would apply to anyone. I don't think there's any question about that. I can cover a song. I can play it live and pay a royalty. According to ASCAP, I can record it, and I can sell it and pay whatever the statutory fee is. Like I said, I think it's 9 cents
or a negotiated fee, right?
Right, or a negotiated fee. I think the other things, creating a studio version, those things are essentially going to be derivative works.
Yeah, I think the key thing in 114 is this sentence right here. The exclusive rights of the owner of copyright in a sound recording do not extend to the making of another sound recording that consists entirely of an independent fixation of other sounds, even though such sounds imitate or simulate those in the copyrighted sound recording. And I think that's the door they're trying to drive this through.
So if that did apply to this case, though, wouldn't that just totally eviscerate Section 106, and then people would kind of be able to just run a ripped MP3 through a psychoacoustic model or something similar and be able to sell them.
I mean, MP3 itself and its compression does actually use psychoacoustic techniques, and I guess we were a little tough on the psychoacoustic phrase because it sounds kind of psycho, but it is an actual real thing that's done. And basically, as Ben pointed out, it's compressing away stuff that you're not going to hear anyway. So, yes, it would completely eviscerate copyright law if they were successful here. So I don't think it would be successful, to make a prediction.
Anyone else think that there's some sort of viable legal argument here?
No. And that was actually borne out. that was a little strong of me. I don't think that there's any viable legal argument. And Judge agrees with me in that he doesn't think that... He thinks that BMI's argument is strong enough to...
EMI.
EMI?
Yes.
What did I say? BMI?
Yes.
Okay,
E
as in elephant. EMI's argument is strong enough to enjoin any further selling by Bluebeat. So they're currently not allowed to stream or sell this music. The judge thought that EMI's arguments were strong enough to have a substantial likelihood of success. And that's not a huge burden to meet, but the judge seemed kind of amazed that this was happening.
Right, so they did issue a temporary restraining order, I believe, or a TRO, last week, right?
Yes, the 5th, which was Thursday.
Okay, well, this is certainly a really interesting case because it's, for lack of a better word, it is an extremely novel defense to copyright infringement, I think. But a really interesting one because it kind of showed you how you can use some of the denser language in the Copyright Act to try to claim different things that might not actually be there or are just a little bit attenuated or ambiguous under the language. But I guess good lawyering to some extent. So any final thoughts before we cap off this week?
No, I'm all set.
All set.
Good to go.
I guess I'll stick in a final thought. Bilski is coming up before the Supreme Court.
Yes, so Bilski is argued on Monday, is it?
Yeah, so this will be posted Monday night. Arguments will have been completed by the time this gets posted, but we're recording before then.
Yes, so we're recording on Sunday today. So November 9th is when the Bilski arguments are presented before the Supreme Court. So by the time that you actually get our podcast, you should make sure to tune in to some of the oral arguments, which I think will be posted somewhere online. I'm sure you'll be able to find them, and everybody will be talking about it, so I'm sure we'll have some interesting things to say next week on our show. So thanks for listening again, and you can visit our website at technicallylegal.org. You can follow us on Twitter at @techlegal. And once again, signing off, my name is David O'Brien, and with me this week...
Dominic Rabier.
Ben Snitkoff.
And David Liu.
Thanks for listening. Have a great week.